any of us who've been in it for long enough, our entire career has been littered with jobs that we didn't get, projects that we thought were going to go for sure, dozens of unproduced scripts littering the floor.
All of us are running into both major and minor failures in Hollywood every single day.
For every success, there is months, sometimes even years, of painful failure.
This is one of the only businesses I can think of where failure is the default. That's the norm. You have to be able to persevere.
Like everything in our business, your hands get calloused and it all bounces off you. That process takes years. That doesn't happen overnight.
I was being told by my manager, it's yours to lose. And I promptly lost it. And I remember thinking like, well, that's it for me. I blew my one big shot. What I've realized from that moment is it's never one big shot. There will be other shots.
Screaming into the Hollywood Abyss is brought to you by Scriptation, the Emmy award-winning app that instantly transfers your notes into new drafts in seconds. Scriptation allows you to digitally mark up scripts, separate notes into layers, track changes across revisions, and so much more. Insert Noah saying something nice about Scriptation.
Dan, I think this is where they actually want me to talk about how much I love it. And I do love it. It's great. Its collating function transformed me from the messiest writer in Hollywood to, well, ever so slightly less messy. My wife might have other things to say about that. Scriptation listeners can get a free month of Scriptation by going to scriptation.com/Scriptation.
For those of you who don't understand slightly drawly American accents, that's scriptation.com/Scriptation. If you're wondering about timelines, this episode was recorded before the strike ended. Welcome back to Screaming Into the Hollywood Abyss, a podcast about rejection, failure, and adversity in the entertainment industry. I am, as ever, your non-entertainment co-host, Dan Rutstein.
And depending on when this airs, I'm your hopefully not still on strike co-host, Noah Ebslin. On today's Screaming Into the Hollywood Abyss, I'm thrilled to introduce TV writer, showrunner, and executive producer Lisa Morales. Lisa has worked on such shows as Shameless, Rosewood, Bluff City Law, and Queen Sugar. She was also the executive producer and showrunner of two sentence horror stories on the old CW that no longer exists. Welcome, Lisa.
Nice to meet you guys. Thanks for having me. Yes, that was my quote. I'm sorry, CW.
Good. So let's start. I'm trying to think of the right question. For some guests, I prepare sort of very specific questions about their career. Other ones, I like to just do a sort of random failure question. So let's start with a random failure question. Lisa, have you ever crashed a car or anyone else's car as part of your professional working life?
Yes. I was James Cameron's assistant from before Titanic to the Academy Awards was my last night. And in the middle of that gig, I decided to crash his Hummer while I was driving in Malibu. And I thought that was the end of me in Hollywood, but luckily it wasn't. He was very understanding and I was forgiven. But yes, I crashed Jim Cameron's Hummer when I was his assistant.
Fantastic. I'm glad that question.
Terrifying moment in my career.
But look, I mean, obviously joking aside, I'm sure you had a great working relationship with him, but there are probably assistants in Hollywood who've been fired for a lot less than crashing somebody's Hummer.
Guaranteed.
Given the nature of Hollywood work, when you had to make the phone call to say, you know, this Hummer of yours, it is crashed, how did that play out? And genuinely, were you worried that there would be a Hollywood overreaction?
I was terrified. I thought I'd lose my job right then and there. And my time in Hollywood was over when it was just starting. But he was amazing and he was gracious. And I drove up to the house with a messed up Hummer. And Jim, I got to tell you something. He's like, what? Let's go see. I go out there. He's like, all right. Just, you know, get it fixed. I can't drive it around like this because it looks like I'm a bad driver. And that was it. And I looked at him and sincerely thanked him for being gracious. And I thought you're going to kill me. He's like, you know, Lisa, it's stuff. I don't get emotional about stuff. you know, which is typical Jim Cameron. He cares about the product. He cares about the film, the work, the shot. But the little stuff, you know, my experience with him was that he was go with the flow and deal with it, you know? So, yeah, the reputation doesn't always equal the reality.
I do want to add that, you know, I, too, have a James Cameron story that I'm not going to go into. But right behind me is my dog. And that dog, which you guys can't see, James Cameron did come up to and say, "You have a very beautiful dog," one day at a random breakfast that he was sitting next to me at. So and we had brought our dog. So if Cameron loves my dog, that's probably should go on the top of any of my, you know, bios. But, you know, so let's you crash James Cameron's Hummer and somehow you crash your way in. This is my segue. You crash your way into a staff writing job, you know, in Hollywood. Did it take you longer than you thought?
You're missing 15 years in between.
All right, let's get into that part.
Cameron's, literally the Academy Awards was my last night because I knew it'd be probably a good 8 to 10 years before he did his next film. So I went looking for, I was writing, but I was too scared to start the writing career yet. So in like 97, 98, actually, I think I left him around 98. I ended up as an assistant at John Wells Productions. And I was at John Wells Productions from assistant to senior vice president and as a development executive until 2010, where I then ended up switching careers and starting over and went on Shameless as a story, as a staff writer. So I had a whole other career, which, you know, makes me a little different than most writers as an executive. I was on the other side. I was on the dark side and, you know, giving notes, working with writers. I was on the feature side. So that was what I knew well. And, you know, was there when Damien Chazelle was launching his career, had a project with him and, you know, Arash Amel. So I got to work with young writers just starting up and I loved it, but I always knew I wanted to write. I was just scared. I was scared. You know, when you're a development executive, it's very social. You go to Comic-Con, you go to Sundance, you do drinks, you go to screenings. And John Wells is such a tight company. We'd all been together for, you know, 8 to 10 years together, a bunch of executives all over town right now that I can name, from Jenny Howe to Tracy Underwood, that have all come up together. So I was scared to take the leap. And at the time I thought I was going to be a feature writer. The idea of being, you know, in my shed writing by myself terrified me. And I just wasn't ready. And then finally, as TV was picking up and cable took off like crazy and streaming and like the most interesting stuff was happening on television, I had the opportunity. I wrote a script. John liked it. I had a feature script that ended up on the blacklist. And that's how he found out I was writing on the side. But I had the opportunity to go on Shameless on season 4 and season 5. And that's, yeah, it took 15 years to get there.
The, you know, we had Jan Nash, who's actually my current showrunner, if I was on a show and not on a strike, one of my current showrunners, and she had the same experience where she was a high level exec and then she jumped over and became a writer. I was a non-writing producer for years. And I always told my wife, it felt like I'm climbing the wrong ladder. And the higher I got, the more uncomfortable I got climbing that ladder, because it felt like I was getting further and further away from the career that I wanted. But did John Wells sit you down and go, "Are you crazy?" Or was he understanding? Because he's a writer too, right? Like, why would you ever want to do this? You have jobs.
No, he got it. You know, I mean, he's a producer and John's a master producer. I mean, he's a great writer, but he's a master producer. So he got it. But he didn't give me that talk. He said, "What do you do, kid? You're not getting any younger. Do you want to be a studio exec? Do you want to keep?" Because I'd been there for so long. You know, you get complacent. Or do you want to write? And you're not getting any younger. Is if you're going to do this, it's time to do this. Like, leap. And I had two bosses, one of the best in features, one of the best in TV. And I didn't, you know, I was get out there in the world. So luckily I had a soft landing ground and ended up on Shameless for him when he gave me that opportunity. But that created a little bit of an imposter syndrome for me, which it took me a while to get over. Like, did I deserve to be here? Yes, I wrote a feature that got attention. Yes, I wrote a sample that proved that I could write TV. But it took, you know, those first two seasons, you know, here you're, and I don't know if you guys know anything about Shameless, but it tends to be very top heavy with all executive producers and one staff writer or story editor to kind of break them in. So here I am surrounded by these amazing playwrights and screenwriters, TV writers, and me. And, you know, I'd never been in a writer's room before besides to visit it. I was the person that was used to giving notes and breaking out writers. And a lot of times I'd met all those writers because they had pitched projects to me. So, you know, it took me a while to get my feet under me. I mean, sure, I could pitch ideas. That was easy. But to just to find my place in a writer's room and realize what does it mean to be a TV writer? What does it mean to this life to come in, to prep, to do all that? So it wasn't easy in that sense. And after two seasons, John's like, you need to go out there and spread your wings and get new bosses and experience new writer's room. But, you know, it took a moment. And then I landed on Rosewood, and, you know, your show's about mistakes and failures. And it was the first time in my career where I lost my job. And it wasn't because so much about my performance at all. I mean, Todd Harthen's a great showrunner and a good guy. I think it was about my confidence level. And I showed a little bit of fear in the writer's room. And when the time came and they needed more help and, you know, someone had to go, I was the person that probably had the least confidence in that moment. And I lost my job, which was devastating. And it took me over two years to jump back. So, and to find my voice.
Mm-hmm. Sorry to interrupt this. I want to explore a bit more on this because, you know, we did warn you that we don't really care about how successful you are. This is what we've come for. So talk to me about what that's like in terms of not so much the firing, but the before that, the sort of, given that you've been in a room before, you know, what was it about that room where you didn't feel confident? Is it, you know, is it you? Is it the way that room is run? Like, describe what left you feeling like that is why it all happened.
No, the writers in the room were super supportive and great, but, you know, they were in their stride and at that point in their careers. And that machine, John's, you know, a master room runner. I mean, he's run so many shows and it's such a machine, and we meet, you know, that particular room, Shameless, meets 3 times a week for 3 hours a week, and we get it all done. So it just runs like a machine with all pros. And I think for me, it was like, I was questioning, was I good enough, or was I here because I'd been a loyal employee for John for 15 years or whatever it was, 12 years. And he saw something in me, was giving me an opportunity. I was questioning whether I could live up to that opportunity at the time. I knew I could, but there was just something in me was like, am I in over my head? Because I was thrown in the deep end, you know, like this room had already started. I joined it like, I think the second or third month that it was in. So I was catching up from the get-go. I wasn't there to break the season at the beginning of my first season. So it was just me getting in my own way and my own insecurities that were wondering, like, do I deserve to be here? When I'd hear stories about writers that struggled and struggled and struggled, and had I paid my dues? And at that moment, I wasn't sure if I had, you know, and it's kind of like sometimes when you meet success and maybe you're not ready for success just yet. I think it was kind of one of those cases. It's okay. I had to earn it when I was unemployed for 2 years. So at that time I got over that moment, but, you know, and I hadn't had a new job in 12, 15 years. I had, you know, been in this safe space as an executive for so long. You know, don't get me wrong. Being an executive is hard. It definitely has its hard moments. But it's different, you know. I was comfortable and I had to get out of my comfort zone as a writer.
Yeah. So tell us about the moment. You know, did he call you into a room? Was it over the phone? How, if you can remember, I know sometimes with these things, you remember the outcome, but you don't remember how they told you. But tell us about the actual sort of moment of being fired and how they phrased it and what you said and how you
Well, with John, it was very comfortable. That wasn't a let go. That was more like, you need to spread your wings. You need to experience other rooms. When I lost my job on Rosewood, it was, I had just come back from set. I delivered my script. Everybody loved the script, handled my producing duties, came in. And I knew that there were other things going on separate of me. And he needed to bring in a higher level writer and there wasn't enough money to cobble it together. So I knew that was in the background. I just didn't think it was me. But he came into my office. He said, you know, I hate this because I like you and you deliver your script and you deliver it on time and you deliver it on set, but I'm going to have to let you go because I need someone with more experience. And I was devastated. I couldn't get out of that place quick enough. I packed up my office as quick as I could be. And I was devastated. I was like, wow, am I ever going to get a job again? I just didn't see it coming, you know, and I was assured it wasn't me. It wasn't my performance. It wasn't my writing, but every fear that I had about, was I deserving to be here? I didn't listen to the good stuff. I only listened to that little voice that was terrifying me. And in my opinion, it was probably the best thing that could have happened to me because that forced me to figure out what I was doing that was getting in my own way. It wasn't the talent. It wasn't the what I was putting down on paper. It was me believing that I deserved to be here and that I had earned my way from the experience that I had before that was transferable. And it also was me digging a little bit deeper and writing that sample that was going to kick ass and get attention. You know, maybe the two samples I'd written before were a little bit safer or what I thought people wanted. Instead, I wrote something super dark and super messed up that got me attention and gets me interviews, you know, and ultimately led to me being a showrunner. But that's what it took. It took 2 years of me sitting there. And there were some dark moments, man. There were some, do I need to quit? You know, my mom's like, you left it. You know, I'm a first generation of immigrants. It's like, you left a senior vice president job to do this. And are you crazy? So it took some moments. And what I had to come down to was believing that, one, I had the talent. Two, I had the drive. Three, I wanted it. And more important than all of that was I deserved to be here. And I had to finally get to a place where I believe that and learn how to interview, learn how to do showrunning meetings with other showrunners, learn to, you know, to kind of advance yourself. So it was all for the, you know, and then after that, my career skyrocketed. After that, it moved fast, it moved quick. My old experience as an executive informed my ability to run a room. But I was $75,000 in debt. I was unsure if I'd ever get a job again, you know?
One of my sort of most memorable moments in Hollywood was sitting in the private practice room as a researcher and assistant with 14 superstar writers. Shonda hired great writers. And they all spent 2 hours, for whatever reason, talking about all the times they'd all been fired from their jobs. And that they all, and every one of them had been fired from one job or another. And it was sort of this reassuring epiphany that we get fired a lot in this job. And I also want to add kind of what, you know, this light bulb went off when you're talking about the 2 years you spent in development or honing your craft or in between jobs or whatever you want to call it, that, you know, why we are so prepared for this current strike. Hopefully it's not a current strike when this airs, but that we do all go through these periods of time where you aren't getting paid. And you have to survive and you have to steel yourself for what's coming next. But I want to talk about, you know, I remember when I went through a short gap and there was this, I got the next job that I kind of had job after from. And it was like, it brings you to tears because you don't ever think it might be coming. You just don't know what's going to happen. What was your next job and how did your approach change to that room where you probably had already realized that maybe this was a confidence issue, not a talent issue? Was your approach different as a writer in that room?
I think there were two things. One, when I got my next job was Queen Sugar. And one of the big things was the showrunner in that room, Anthony Sparks, became a mentor. And he saw that I was talented and he encouraged me to give more and he encouraged me to step up. And being seen and being recognized was what I needed at the right time. But I was also ready to accept that. And I mean, I just came in. I don't know if my job, my work ethic was any different. I just think I just knew how to kind of sell myself better and sell myself more. And I think I just chilled out, to be honest with you. I think I had gone through a breakup of a long-term relationship. I had lost my father on the first day, the day before the writer's room had started. And I was unemployed for 2 months and so freaking in debt. In other words, it's just a job, like care, but don't give a shit, which is something that a fellow writer, Liz Segal, had given me advice on. Because my agent realized, like, I'm getting in my head too much. And I sat down with her and Liz Segal, if you're hearing this, you kind of changed my life. We went to lunch. She said, Lisa, you've got to learn to care, but to not give a shit. And that kind of way of thinking kind of helped me not get in the way and think like, oh my God, like, you know, we get anxiety in the writer's room. If your pitch flops or, you know, everything you've done for that week seems to not be hitting and you're worried about, do people think that you don't get the show or whatever. There was a moment where I just stopped caring about that. And my thing was just to come there, do the best thing I could do. Pitch the best ideas I could give, help the other writers as much as I could. And I stopped worrying. I got out of my body, so to speak. I stopped worrying about the perceptions of other people and I just did my job. And when that moment came, it changed everything. And I was able to perform better under pressure and quicker and faster and that this is a job that the least, when you're less, when you're, the more unself-conscious you are, the better you perform. And when you learn that little magic thing, and it's one of the pieces of advice I give young writers, just get out of your head. Don't worry about if the pitch fails or this or that. Just keep doing it. Just keep grinding it out. When you get out of your own way is when you think the, you think the best. You know, you're in the zone, just like an athlete. And when I learned that, everything changed. But I had a mentor, and I had someone that encouraged me. And then I had a second mentor when I went on Bless the Allow with Dean Jagaris. Those are two people that really kind of helped uplift me. And at that point, you know, we built confidence, and it went from there.
Look, I've never heard it quite phrased like that, but that's a really interesting approach. Obviously, Noah with his podcasting definitely takes that approach. He doesn't really care if the questions are terrible or not. He just sort of goes through it and doesn't even listen.
That's what you want in the room.
and maybe that was actually a good thing.
For me, getting out of my head and just being in the moment.
No, but the care bit,
it's like care, but don't give a shit. Care, the give a shit is what you take home with you and you get anxiety about. Caring is you showing up on the job. You know, I'd love to say that it's mine, but like I said, Liz Segal is the one that gave me the bit of advice. It was literally, and I mean, I have given this piece to everybody I can think of that will listen to it. It's like care, but don't give a shit. It matters. It means you don't take it home with you as much. You don't belabor the moment that you screwed up in the room a little. If you, no one's paying attention, nobody cares. You know, let's just keep rolling.
I mean, and the sad thing is, for the most part, this job doesn't give a shit about you, right? It absolutely doesn't give a shit about you. So it goes both ways. They care about you, but they don't give a shit about you, and you're part of a cog, and you know, you help them along. So now we're moving through your career. You've had some mentors. You've had some great mentors, actually, it sounds like, in your life and in career. When did you decide, and how did you manifest your move into showrunner? When did you decide you were ready, and how did that actually happen for you?
Right place, right time. Luck, preparation, all of it. You know, it was a little low-budget show on CW, two-sentence horror story, an anthology show. I mean, there's nothing on my resume that says I do horror. But my sample's dark, so you can see the horror in it. But, you know, I was put up for this at first. I ignored the submission. I'm like, I'm not a showrunner. I mean, come on. You know, it's like co-EP, really? I'm going to jump. My sister reads a bunch of my submissions, because at this point I was getting behind and I had submissions. She's like, you need to look at this. So I did. And I looked at the show and I'm like, okay, this is cool. Writing 12 little movies, or 10, I don't remember what it was, 10 or 12 little movies, you know, 20 minute movie. I could do this. My old life is coming forward to meet my writing life, and I can do this. They're just a bunch of shorts. So I went after the job hard. I prepped for it. I did a slide presentation. I did a music presentation. I went crazy. I put the whole thing together. And when I did that interview, I got lucky. They liked my take on it, and got the job, got the offer. It was literally luck, right place, right time during COVID, and it all kind of came together. They couldn't afford a fancy showrunner, so they needed someone that they could break out. And that happened to be, you know, change my life moment. Thank you, CW.
Oddly enough, I think that was with Stage 13, right? I was also 14 with Stage 13 when they kind of went belly up just in a normal Hollywood way. This amazing little company that was doing interesting things just got... Mm-hmm. You
know. And taking chances on people that maybe didn't have an opportunity. But yeah, it was... I mean, what I came to find out is all that experience that I had working with writers before helped in the writer's room. You know, I knew how to foster that. Being on set and being on, you know, feature productions beforehand, all my previous experience set me up pretty nicely to succeed in that job as a showrunner. Now, I mean, showrunning is the greatest gig in the world. It's exhausting. It wears you down beyond belief. But to me, it's a job that's kind of ready made for me. Not that I wouldn't be a number two or number three again, don't get me wrong, but it's a job that I kind of like the stress of it all and the organizational aspects of it, the people managing aspects of it, and just getting to see a project from beginning to end and, you know, discovering that, oh, I'm good at editing or I'm good at this. It was a really fascinating experience.
Can we talk, and if we can't, we can edit this out, but can we talk a little bit now about the mini room? Like you and I came into contact with each other, and I guess I could say we've known each other for a couple of years because we've sort of both worked in the CBS sort of, and you had some questions about.
I've interviewed with your boss, Jan and Chris, for NCIS New Orleans. Yes.
And you got a big gig running a room, or at least a mini room, you know, trying to create that type of network procedural for Puerto Rico. What was that experience like?
It was challenging. It was another level of my career to fine tune a whole other, you know, another additional, all that skill sets. Again, as a showrunner, it was the second time around of running a room. It was not enough time in the world to do what we were asked to do. And it illuminated why we are on strike now. And hopefully when this comes out, we won't be anymore. But, you know, look, I had great partners at Kaplan Entertainment, and I had great partners at, as far as the development on the CBS side. At the same time, I feel guilty to this day that I had five supervising producers to EPs making minimum, that I'm sure if they were getting their quote, they wouldn't be hurting as much right now during the strike for those 12 to 15 weeks that I had them. You know, it bothers me that here is one of the wealthiest corporations in the world and you're paying five EPs scale. So, and you're giving us 12 weeks. I extended it. They extended it to 15 weeks to do six scripts and a Bible. So that's the part that kind of, while it was a great experience for me to be able to do this, it's also on the other end kind of bothersome, you know, that I wasn't able to take care of my writers as much as I would have wished I could have, you know, because there's loopholes and they found all the loopholes. Let's pay all these guys minimums for 12 to 15 weeks and get top tier network quality work out of them. You know, it was CBS's, like I said, it was the first time they did a mini room, us in Secret Hideout, I think it was. Why? They didn't, it felt like an experimentation that was going to, like, oh, this is the first time of many mini rooms to come for the networks. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's kind of what it felt, that the direction that we're going in.
So, I want to be slightly careful about asking questions about when the strike's going to end, because it may have ended by the time this episode airs, or it may still be months away from ending, unfortunately. But I get a question for somebody in your position. When it's all over, and I don't know what the outcome will be, obviously, but there'll be some form of agreement, whether it's one that, you know, the strike, the writers like, or they like slightly less, I don't know. But when it's all done, and you go back in to work, ideally as a showrunner again, what's it going to be like, do you think, for the first maybe month, in terms of either sort of what it's like in a room, because obviously everyone will be excited to be back, but then everyone will sort of know that there's been some kind of deal, but then also you're, you know, taking notes or whatever it will be from executives who are part of the company that's put you into strike. What will it be like, do you think? And what sort of things will a showrunner have to do maybe differently in that immediate post-strike world?
I mean, let me start off in saying, I think that the executives that we work with at studios and networks are allies. They're not the money men. They're not the people at the top of the level. I think my experience and the people that I've talked to are all in favor of the strike and are backing us and want us to get as much as possible. Sure, they want to go back to work just as much as we do. But I think that for the most part, the people that Noah and I interact with are allies.
I think those executives, to answer your question too, I know it wasn't directed at me, are as scared as we are. I mean, the ones we do interface with, their careers are as much changing and on the line with AI. They don't necessarily like the changes happening, and they, you know, are equally directly affected by the strike. So I do think that there might be some weird camaraderie created over it as well, that it is those at the tops who have don't understand necessarily even kind of like the business of Hollywood. They've taken over, the tech companies have taken over Hollywood, and they don't, you know, there's a distance between the things they create and what we create, and it's not the same. And I think they're surprised that we're just not coming back, like not accepting the offers. So Lisa, what, you know, strike aside, because we don't know where that's going. Hopefully we're not going to be in it when this airs anymore. What keeps you up at night as a writer? Like where are your fears, you know, about your career, about sustaining a career? A lot of the people on here were in therapy. How do you deal with those fears?
I do therapy. Luckily, you know, I've been in it for a while. So I have a session today at 4 after I get off with you guys, but I only see her about once a month now, just for maintenance. My biggest anxiety is just sustaining. This is a weird thing to say as a second time showrunner, but I don't have a house yet. You know, I'm saving to buy a house. No, we've joked about this, about Porter Ranch or whatever back in on a couple things, but you know, that's one thing for me, but I'm going to be okay. I get submissions, I get interviews, knock on wood. I'm going to be okay. I think what worries me is the next generation. This squeezing of the powers that be wanting to make us more like an animation industry, where it's a showrunner and a couple of freelance writers and no staff. So I think the fight for a minimum writing room is, you know, incredibly important to our future. Because, you know, I think, what are the numbers? There's 11,500 writers in the Writers Guild. I think there's 5,000 or 6,000 that are working writers that are sustaining the guild. If we keep moving to these smaller writers' rooms, what's going to happen? 2,000 working writers sustaining the guild? The guild can't sustain. We can't survive that. So I think there is an existential issue here that we're fighting for. And that scares me, because it scares me that what's going to happen? If I'm having a hard time surviving right now, what's happening to the story editors and the staff writers and the co-producers that haven't been able to save that kind of money to get through a hard time? You know, that's the next generation of storytellers, the next generation of showrunners. And the sustainability of this industry is what concerns me. AI, it's copyright. We'll fight that good fight. I think that's fine. It's really, to me, about what is it going to look like? Are we going to have writers' rooms? Are we going to have these shows that can sustain 4, 5, 6 seasons? Or are we just going to be a collection of small, you know, big movies, 8 episodes a piece, and showrunners are sitting in sheds writing them by themselves with a couple of freelancers? That's not, I don't know. I don't think that's sustainable as an industry. And that's what I'm concerned about. Just what is it going to look like in 5 to 8 years?
Yeah.
You know, I'll be fine. Noah and I will be fine. We'll get gigs, but what happens to the next generation?
So, I mean, on the subject of the next generation, I guess this is unfortunately we're running out of time, as sometimes happens on these podcasts, particularly when we have guests who give great answers. So we are down to the last question, which is about, and I know you've already given some advice earlier on, or at least you've shown us some advice that you were given, which was so helpful. But as you know, the last question is, if you could give a single piece of advice to somebody entering the industry, what would it be? Given what you've literally just said about your worry about the industry, then this is the answer to sort of reflect that.
I mean, you got to want it. And if you want it, you got to write. You got to write it as often as you can, even when it's hard, until you get that break. And, you know, preparation, meeting, luck. That's your break, you know, and then you take advantage. You got to write. John Wells says that you're not a real writer until you've got a foot high of scripts stacked up, bad scripts, until they get better and better and better. But you have to do it, and you have to be committed to the job, and you have to prepare. Number one. Number two, have a balanced life. You know, do whatever you can to keep your mental health, your body, your soul as happy as possible, because your success should not define your happiness, which is a hard thing for a writer to do. Any writer, actors, directors, that tendency to see your level of happiness based on your success and what level you've achieved or how many shows you're on is very tempting. So I think keep your mental health as healthy as possible. Have friends, go out, join writers groups, just take a walk, you know, live life and get outside a little bit. Those are the two things. Work hard, but then play hard and take care of yourself. I think it is a grind. This business is a grind. Even when you're rolling and you're getting job after job and we're successful, it's still a grind. And there's always someone that's going to try to push you off. So the more centered you can be, the better, I think, is the one piece. So two pieces of advice. I lied. Two.
No, that's fine. Two's allowed. So look, Lisa Morales, thank you very much for being part of our podcast. I care enormously about the quality of this episode.
But
I don't give a shit who listens to it. But
care, but don't give a shit.
Thank you very much for being part of the show.
Guys, it was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Screaming Into the Hollywood Abyss, brought to you by Scriptation. Thank you, as ever, to James Launch for the music. And thank you to our loyal listeners. And if there's any showrunners out there who want to hear their fellow showrunners abused and ruffled around and put under the microscope, so you can hear their stories of rejection, failure, and adversity, please send them our way. If you are interested in following us on social media, no, I've lost track.
I am at N. Ebslin on Twitter or X or whatever Elon Musk now calls it. And thanks to Elon Musk, I'm also at Noah Ebslin on Hive, Spoutable, Blue Sky, Threads, Mastodon, MySpace, Friendster, and I'm sure a thousand more.